The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Wrap up the news of the week with the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Let's begin with the latest from the White House.
Download the podcast and go beyond the week's headlines with host Steve Dorsey and analysis from CBS News correspondents across the globe.
I'm Stephen Portnoy at the White House.
I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
So I'm Vicki Barker in London.
Don't miss the CBS News Weekend Roundup with new episodes available Friday afternoons wherever you download podcasts.
This is CBS News. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. A top North Korean official at the White House.
It ended up being a two-hour conversation with the second most powerful man in North Korea.
Plus,
to be totally candid, this White House faces a very serious problem.
What challenge top White House press aide Raj Shaw says is plaguing the Trump administration, and later, why tensions are flaring in communities threatened by a Hawaiian volcano. I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend at the White House. It's where President Trump met with a top aide to Kim Jong-un Friday, Kim Jong-chol.
Went very well. It's really a get-to-know-you kind of a situation.
The president also confirming his June 12th summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un to talk about denuclearizing North Korea is back on.
I think you're going to have a very positive result in the end.
Mr. Trump says he also received a letter from Kim Jong-un at his White House meeting Friday.
This was a meeting where a letter was given to me by Kim Jong-un, and that letter was very nice letter. Oh, would you like to see what was in that letter?
Now to trade. The Trump administration is hitting some of the country's closest allies with new steel and aluminum tariffs. CBS's Stephen Portnoy reports from the White House, Mexico, Canada, and the EU had been exempted from those tariffs.
Just before the exemption was to expire, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross flew to Paris to try to achieve a last-minute deal. But he told reporters the Europeans demanded a permanent exemption from the tariffs.
We were not prepared to meet that condition.
Ross says the U.S. remains open to further trade negotiations, but EU countries may now retaliate for the aluminum and steel tariffs. Mexico says it will impose new duties on U.S. steel, pork, apples, grapes, and cheeses. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, The White House.
More tariffs could be in store, including those targeting China. Raj Shaw is White House Principal, Deputy Press Secretary. Raj, how close are we to hiking tariffs on something like $50 billion worth of Chinese goods?
It's something that's being seriously considered. Look, China has engaged in decades of what we would describe as economic aggression. China engages in dumping. They engage in forced technology transfers. They engage in theft of intellectual property. There's a whole host of bad actions by either state actors or Chinese companies that the United States wants to confront. So the answer is, you know, the president is seeking free, fair, and reciprocal trade with China, and tariffs to get China to act more fairly. It may be part of the mix of actions we need to undertake to get that goal.
Okay, but there could be some kind of Chinese retaliation, which could be on $50 billion of U.S. goods. How prepared is the U.S. for that?
I think that, you know, the United States is prepared to address any actions that China undertakes, but we need to be clear about this, that, you know, we need to push China and aggressively confront these actions which are unfair to American workers and American farmers and American businesses.
I want to talk to you, Raj, also about something a little different, something you addressed with my colleague Stephen Portnoy at the White House briefing a few weeks ago about White House aide Kelly Sadler's comments about John McCain. There was a lot of talk in the aftermath of that about leaks inside the White House. With all the talk from the White House about clamping down on leaks, has the White House really responded in an effective way, do you think?
You know, I think that leaks are a significant problem that any White House faces. I think, to be totally candid, this White House faces a very serious problem with people releasing confidential information that are not authorized to do so, and undermining our ability to do our jobs and to effectively communicate the president's message. And also, in certain instances, disclosing information that is classified, that is very sensitive in nature, and harms our ability to effectively advocate for the United States. So there are some leaks that are more serious than others. I think that one leak is too many, and there are more than one leak coming out of this administration, coming out of this White House. And until there are no unauthorized leaks, I don't think we've been entirely effective.
Also, I want to talk to you about something that's been in the news lately, and that's the First Lady's absence from the public spotlight. Something like more than 2 weeks she's gone missing. She had that kidney procedure. Can you tell us about how the president is communicating with her and what her role is and where she is these days at the White House?
The First Lady is healthy. She's, been recovering. And, I wouldn't read too much into the fact that she hasn't been in the public spotlight too much of late. I think that's just overreading the situation. She's in good health. We're very happy that her procedure went well and for all the well wishes that others have provided.
Is she still recovering?
No, she is in fine health, and I'm not going to get into commenting on that. All I'll say is that there's been a lot of fuel to this fire by a media that, seeks to, ask questions first and raise questions and raise a specter of things before it gets answers. There's nothing untoward, nothing to announce. The First Lady is in fine health, and she's been at the White House with the president and the residents.
White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Raj Shaw. Good talking to you, Raj.
Thanks, Steve.
President Trump also announced a new pardon Thursday and what others he's considering. Here's CBS's Paula Reed.
President Trump granted his fifth pardon, tweeting, "We will be giving a full pardon to Dinesh D'Souza today. He was treated very unfairly by our government." The high-profile conservative filmmaker and author pleaded guilty in 2014 to arranging illegal campaign contributions. D'Souza has said his prosecution was politically motivated.
"I've gone through, you know, going to jail."
Mr. Trump also said he is thinking about pardoning Martha Stewart, who is convicted of lying to investigators about a stock trade, and commuting former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's 14-year sentence for attempting to sell an appointment to the Senate seat vacated by President Obama.
You're fired.
Both Stewart and Blagojevich have connections to Mr. Trump's Apprentice television franchise. At the same point in his presidency, Mr. Obama had not pardoned anyone, but eventually issued 212 pardons and 1,715 commutations, most for low-level drug offenders. President Trump issued his first pardon last summer to controversial Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He was charged for ignoring a court order to stop profiling Latinos. Last week, he issued a posthumous pardon of boxing legend Jack Johnson at the behest of Sylvester Stallone.
Jack Johnson was not treated fairly.
Well, the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, faces over 15 years in prison from charges filed by special counsel. But sources tell me he is not expected to cooperate because he is banking on a presidential pardon to avoid jail time. The president's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, also likely faces federal charges, but is not expected to cooperate and also could get a pardon. But a presidential pardon only protects you from federal jail time, not any state-level charges. Paula Reed, CBS News, the White House.
Still to come, how the White House is responding to controversial comments from two different comedians. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. President Trump says the head of Disney owes him an apology. It comes after ABC canceled the reboot of Roseanne after the star was accused of racism.
"Well, at least Norman Bates respected his mother."
The day after ABC pulled the plug on her number one show over a racist tweet, Roseanne Barr returned to Twitter with a vengeance. Barr, a prominent supporter of President Trump, retweeted an image questioning why some people think it's okay to ridicule him as an ape, but not Valerie Jarrett. "I thought she was white," she wrote. "I am not a racist. I am tired of being smeared over a stupid mistake erasing 30 years of activism." Barr, who is Jewish, then went on to suggest that she was the victim, tweeting, "I think I spent the last 24 hours watching the party of inclusion, diversity, understanding, and acceptance lynch a Jew." On Wednesday, Mr. Trump waded into the controversy, complaining Disney CEO Bob Iger never apologized for horrible statements made about him on Disney's networks. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
Where was Bob Iger's apology to the White House staff for Jemele Hill calling the president and anyone associated with him a white supremacist?
Disney slash ABC Television Group President Ben Sherwood defended the decision to dump Barr, telling his staff, in the end, it came down to doing what's right.
So here we go again.
On ABC's The View, Whoopi Goldberg criticized Barr for retweeting this fake image of Goldberg wearing an offensive anti-Trump shirt.
That just because you were caught with your pants down, don't try to drag other people down with you.
Vladimir Duthier reporting. Meanwhile, late-night comedian Samantha Bee has apologized for a crude comment she made about Ivanka Trump.
Let me just say, one mother to another, do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless He listens to you.
These comments aired during her TBS show Full Frontal Wednesday night. The White House called them vile and vicious. In a statement, Bee called her comments inappropriate and inexcusable. A new law championed by President Trump promises to offer new hope to terminally ill people.
As President Trump signed the Right to Try bill Wednesday, 8-year-old Jordan McClin went in for a hug. He missed the first few times, but eventually they embraced. A hug years in the making. Jordan has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a genetic degenerative disease with an average life expectancy of around 25 years.
And to see it just finally come to the finish line was just this huge, huge accomplishment.
Jordan and his mother, Laura McClin, have been at the forefront of the movement to pass the Right to Try bill, which allows the terminally ill who have exhausted all other options to gain access to drugs not fully approved yet by the FDA. We first met the McClin family in 2015 when Right to Try was signed into law in their home state of Indiana by then-Governor Mike Pence.
He has been very, very supportive all along the way.
Under FDA regulations, new drugs must go through three phases of clinical trials before becoming commercially available, which often takes years. Right to Try now allows doctors to administer drugs that have cleared just the first phase of a trial.
We're going to be saving tremendous numbers of lives.
But opponents of Right to Try argue so-called compassionate use treatments already allow patients to try experimental drugs. The FDA currently approves about 99% of experimental drug requests.
Unfortunately, it's empty symbolism.
Allison Bateman House, an assistant professor of medical ethics, fears the bill gives false hope.
Nobody can force a company to give a drug if it doesn't want to. I am not optimistic that it is going to be a pathway of getting access for patients.
But Laura McClin is still hopeful.
We've met so many people from different disease groups that can benefit from this law.
If I had that head of hair, I would have been president so long ago.
As for Jordan, he had a long day, but meeting the president was worth it.
He said my hair was very nice.
He did.
Yeah. Correspondent Adriana Diaz reporting. Former President George H.W. Bush was sent back to the hospital for low blood pressure. He's been at his summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine.
The day before he was hospitalized with fatigue and low blood pressure, President George H.W. Bush joined fellow veterans at a pancake breakfast to mark Memorial Day. Brent Scowcroft, his former national security advisor, was also there. Just last week, hundreds of people waving American flags welcomed Mr. Bush back to Kennebunkport.
I think it's important because he's had such a difficult year that he comes back in a place that he's comfortable with, that he's happy with.
Take a flag.
He has spent nearly every summer in the quaint southern Maine town where his family owns a compound.
I'll go get more.
And on Sunday, there were plenty of well-wishers for the 41st president.
After losing his wife and now coming home, and everyone's been so excited to see him and support him.
In April, Mr. Bush was hospitalized in Texas for nearly 2 weeks, battling an infection. He became ill the day after the funeral of his wife, Barbara. The 93-year-old also suffers from a form of Parkinson's, uses a wheelchair, and has had repeated bouts with pneumonia. Chip Reed, CBS News, Biddeford, Maine.
Missouri's Lieutenant Governor Mike Parson taking control of the state this weekend after Eric Greitens announced his resignation Tuesday.
I am announcing that I will resign as governor of Missouri effective Friday, June 1st at 5 p.m.
Missouri Governor Eric Greitens announced his resignation as possible impeachment proceedings were bearing down on him. Earlier in the day, a judge ruled a secret group supporting the 44-year-old governor must turn over documents and correspondence showing potential coordination between that group and the governor's campaign committee.
I know, and people of good faith know, that I am not perfect, but I have not broken any laws nor committed any offense worthy of this treatment.
The first-term Republican governor was under fire for allegedly misusing a charity donor list and an extramarital affair with his former hairdresser. He said mounting stress over the accusations and mounting legal bills led to his decision.
The last few months have been incredibly difficult for me, for my family.
The governor's resignation comes 17 months after taking office. Greitens, a rising star in the GOP, was elected for his brashness and his pledge to root out what he termed corrupt career politicians. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, Washington.
On Friday, a new jobs report showed the economy continuing to chip away at unemployment. Here's CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
Retail, healthcare, construction, specifically retailers, added 31,000 jobs. Healthcare increased by 29,000 in May, and construction continued on an upward trend. Construction jobs, 25,000 added in May, and construction jobs have risen by 286,000 over the past 12 months.
Vermont's trying to lure more telecommuters to move there. CBS Money Watch's Diane King Hall has the details.
If you're looking for a fresh start, Vermont will soon pay people to move there and, get this, work remotely. Beginning in 2019, the state will pay $10,000 over the course of 2 years. The money would cover relocation expenses, technology, and other work-related expenses.
Up next, new evacuations in part of Hawaii as a volcano continues to erupt.
This is a neighborhood, and people have lost homes.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How do we know you're telling the truth?
Because I have no reason to lie.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Lava from a still-erupting volcano in Hawaii is wreaking more havoc as more people are told to evacuate this weekend. Correspondent Carter Evans is on the Big Island with more.
The massive amount of lava in Leilani Estates is spreading fast. In some places, the length of a football field every 10 minutes. And at temperatures of 2,000 degrees, geologists say that's as hot as it gets.
The scientific aspect of this is fascinating, but it's tempered hugely by the fact that this is a neighborhood and people have lost homes.
75 have been destroyed so far. Inside the evacuation zone, tensions are high.
I live here!
61-year-old John Hubbard is accused of opening fire and assaulting a neighbor who came back to check on his property.
Stress is high, anxiety is high. They see strange people in their subdivision and they're trying to protect stuff.
Meanwhile, workers are digging a new evacuation route. Lava has already overrun the main road, Highway 132, leaving people in about 500 homes and vacation rentals with just one escape route left. If the flows cross Highway 137, there would be no way out. The National Guard has helicopters on standby just in case.
We want those people to leave. We don't want to have first responders and National Guardsmen or Marines in helicopters putting their lives at risk to rescue them.
It's just not clear how many people remain inside the evacuation area, but authorities want to make it clear to anyone who stays they may not be able to respond if they need help. Carter Evans, CBS News, Pahoa, Hawaii.
Back on the mainland, it's been a wild week in weather. Correspondent Jeff Begace reports on historic flooding in central Maryland in a community still rebuilding after a devastating flood 2 years ago.
I can already see the floor starting to warp again.
When the floodwaters came racing down Main Street, Jason Barnes' toy store didn't stand a chance. The water was up to the ceiling.
Yeah, and then some, it looks like.
Leaving a basement full of toys underwater. Where do you start the cleanup?
I don't know. I don't know if anything in here will be salvageable.
Like many here, Barnes has no flood insurance. And also, like many others here, he spent much of his savings rebuilding after Ellicott City flooded 2 years ago. They say this flood is worse. On Sunday, the water came rushing down Main Street. And as it progressed down the street, it took the sidewalk with it. The water ran so fast, some shops went from dry to flooded in just minutes.
Everyone's going to start having to ask those hard questions. Can we stay?
This time around, Jason says he's not sure he will. Jeff Begays, CBS News, Ellicott City, Maryland.
One National Guardsman was killed in the floods. His body was found in a river a quarter mile away. Flooding's also being blamed for killing at least one person in Charlottesville, Virginia, where correspondent Chris Van Cleve reports.
Authorities here declared a local emergency. The powerful floodwaters washed out large portions of county roads.
Don't drive through standing water. You know, turn around, don't drown. That's the message here.
This neighborhood is virtually cut off from the rest of the Charlottesville area because the road in and out is gone. Neighbors tell us the creek that runs through here normally is just a trickle, but it rose up and tore through here. The county says banks as high as 12 feet tall remain unstable, and more rain could be on the way. Chris Van Cleve, CBS News, outside Charlottesville, Virginia.
In North Carolina, heavy rain triggered concerns a dam could collapse as rivers across the state bulge and mudslides are reported, prompting Governor Roy Cooper to declare a state of emergency.
I'm Jim Crisula in western North Carolina. The sound of the rain-swollen Broad River here in the Hickory Nut Gorge southeast of Asheville is almost deafening. Engineers say the river's running about 5 feet above normal. Campgrounds along the river have been evacuated, with many summer getaway spots. Travel trailers, cabins, and RVs now swamped. Several riverside restaurants and vacation rentals have been heavily damaged. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Bat Cave, North Carolina.
It's the first weekend of hurricane season.
I'm Peter King. Last year it was Harvey, Irma, Maria. No one knows what storms could hit land this year, if any, but
for these weather events, there is no need to panic. That's the best thing about hurricanes.
National Hurricane Center specialist John Cangelosi says that's because forecasts allow time to prepare. Forecasts have become much more accurate.
Last year was an extremely successful year for us at the Hurricane Center. I mean, we broke all the records for track forecasting.
But he says that's no excuse for not having a plan and being prepared as the season begins.
Psychologically, you'll feel better that you're doing something.
Peter King, CBS News, Lakeland, Florida.
The updated Atlantic hurricane outlook forecasts a near average season. A new study from Harvard researchers estimates 4,600 people died in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, far more than original estimates. Correspondent David Begno visited the island and has this report.
Nice to meet you.
One of the people we talked to was Mildred Castro. Her 83-year-old mother, Adelaida Machuca, depended on supplemental oxygen, but was told by her hospice nurses they'd run out. So Machuca went to the hospital and died 2 months later.
You believe the storm accelerated her death?
Yes, because in my home, she was stable. She was doing fine.
He left the first hospital and died on the way to the second hospital?
Correct.
Wanda Mora from New Jersey told us the night of the hurricane, her father Jose had a heart attack. Over the next 8 days, one hospital didn't have room for him, a second hospital didn't have power, and the Vietnam veteran died in an ambulance on the way to the third hospital.
Do you believe your father's death was related to Hurricane Maria?
I don't believe it. I know it. He absolutely died as an indirect consequence of Hurricane Maria.
These stories are similar to what researchers from Harvard University found in a sample of almost 3,300 households across the island. They found 56 deaths had occurred between the day the storm made landfall to the end of 2017, and they compared it to the same time period a year earlier. Projecting that on the entire population, Harvard estimates the death toll is more than 4,600, possibly as high as 8,000. The government says the official death toll is 64. Hector Pesqueta is the public safety director.
I've not seen any evidence that the government is trying to cover up the number of deaths, but you know people think that.
I understand
You've
that
heard
there
that.
May be.
They What's
may,
the response to that?
The response to that notion is ludicrous.
David Begno, CBS News, on the island of Puerto Rico in San Juan.
New body camera video shows the moments before a Wildwood, New Jersey police officer punched a 20-year-old woman on a beach. Emily Weinman was suspected of underage drinking, and police say she wasn't cooperating and assaulted an officer. Now her lawyer says officers overreacted.
Those officers involved have been reassigned but are reportedly fully trained part-time officers used during the busy beach season. Weinman said on Facebook she was at the beach with her daughter and some friends Saturday and that she had not been drinking when her confrontation with police began.
CBS's Jerika Duncan reporting. Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the bizarre story about a journalist who faked his own death.
Joy among his colleagues when they learned he was, in fact, alive and well.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A bizarre story in Ukraine about Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko, who says he faked his own death to avoid assassination. Here's correspondent Elizabeth Palmer.
Joy among his colleagues when they learned he was, in fact, alive and well. And giving a press conference with Ukrainian security officials to say that his death was 100% fake news. The explanation by Ukraine's security chief bordered on farce. It was all an elaborate hoax to foil an assassination plot by Russian agents. 2 months ago, he claimed, a local man with Russian connections hired a hitman for $30,000 to kill Babchenko. But the hitman didn't do it. Instead, he cooperated with Ukrainian police to stage Babchenko's murder and then went to collect his money. A handoff the Ukrainians say they videotaped covertly. Shortly afterwards, the cameras still rolling, police moved in and arrested the man who'd ordered the hit, who oddly looks as if he was expecting it. Arkady Babchenko was an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. In fact, he fled Moscow for Ukraine last year, saying he feared for his life and got a job as a TV anchor in Kiev. The Ukrainians say Russian security services wanted him dead and were willing to pay for it. But is it true? Who knows?
But critics say that Babchenko has undermined serious journalism everywhere, not least in Russia, where the Kremlin routinely bats away any accusation it doesn't like by calling it fake news. Well, it's now been handed proof. Elizabeth Palmer, CBS News, London.
Uber is taking new action in response to assaults on passengers. Here's CBS News correspondent John Schumo in New York.
I am on 57th Street.
Anne-Marie Brown travels for business and uses Uber all over the country. Safety is always on her mind.
Right now what I'm doing, and I know this sounds crazy, I take a picture of whoever it is and send it to my husband. So this is the person that picked me up.
The ride-sharing company is adding new safety features to ease riders' concerns. One of them, giving passengers a way to call for help if they need it.
The new feature adds an emergency button to the app. It connects you directly to 911 and shows your exact location so you can share it with the dispatcher.
An Uber spokesperson told us that feature should be up and running on every user's phone while they're on a trip.
Excellent, thank you.
For us, it took a few tries. At first, the feature did not show up on 3 out of 4 phones. We contacted Uber, and a few hours later, it was working. The update, first rolled out on Tuesday, is part of Uber's efforts to rehabilitate its image after a series of sexual assaults. Earlier this month, the company's chief legal officer said the process will continue through this year.
It's a journey. We're in the middle of that journey. We're seeing great results as we're moving forward to actually make sure we're doing the right thing.
In certain test markets, the new safety button will send details, including a description of the car, directly to 911.
Feel safer with these new features?
Yeah, definitely do.
Anne Marie sees any step to improve rider safety as a step forward. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
Starbucks shut down its stores across the U.S. for bias training Tuesday. CBS News correspondent Hannah Doba is in New York with more.
Customers heading to this New York City Starbucks for their afternoon coffee fix found they were locked out, while employees received anti-bias training inside.
Do I think 4 hours is enough for training? No, I think like anything, changing a culture is something you do at measure over time.
175,000 employees from Starbucks stores coast to coast are attending 4-hour training sessions.
We are here to make Starbucks a place where everyone feels welcome.
The mandatory training follows the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks last month. They were singled out after one wanted to use the restroom without buying anything while they waited for a friend.
The NAACP, the Perception Institute, and other advocacy groups help Starbucks develop this diversity training curriculum.
The agenda includes a short film.
Helping people see each other fully, completely, respectfully.
From there, employees discuss bias in small groups.
I think it's great that they're taking this step.
I think it's a good PR move.
It's a step in the right direction. I mean, it's not going to cure all ills.
Starbucks has already revised its restroom policy following the Philadelphia incident, announcing its bathrooms are open to anyone. The coffee giant is expected to lose about $12 million in revenue. Anadoba, CBS News, New York.
On Monday, folks will mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert Kennedy. But correspondent Michelle Miller reports new evidence is raising questions about the case.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
After winning the California Democratic primary in the 1968 presidential campaign, Senator Robert Kennedy left a jubilant crowd, exiting through the hotel kitchen.
Would a doctor come right here?
He was shot 3 times and died the next day. Sirhan Sirhan, a 24-year-old Palestinian immigrant, was arrested and later convicted. He admitted shooting Kennedy, but claimed he had no memory of it. Now, new evidence is casting doubt for some on Sirhan's guilt. According to that evidence, Sirhan was standing in front of Kennedy at the time of the shooting, but an autopsy report found that Kennedy was shot at point-blank range from behind. It reportedly shows as many as 13 shots were fired that night, but Sirhan's gun only held 8 bullets. That's one reason why Kennedy's eldest son, Robert Kennedy Jr., visited Sirhan Sirhan in prison. He tells the Washington Post, "There were too many bullets. You can't fire 13 shots out of an 8-shot gun."
All of a sudden, I started shaking and fell.
Paul Schrade, a labor leader who campaigned for the former attorney general, also was hit by gunfire. He's believed for decades that the evidence supports a second gunman.
The prosecution's own evidence that Sirhan did fire 2 shots, missed Kennedy, and shot me.
I want to know what moved Robert Kennedy Jr. to visit Sirhan Sirhan. I could imagine that you had something to do with that.
Well, we've been talking about this a long time. I've talked to other members of the family. One day, right here in this living room, he brought 3 of his youngest kids, and he said, look, Paul, you were there that night. They don't know what happened to their grandfather. Would you please tell them?
The evidence that convicted Sirhan Sirhan was compelling. His confession, eyewitnesses on the scene, and even the weapon that fired those 8 shots. Now, Kennedy wants the investigation into his father's murder reopened. Michelle Miller, CBS News, New York.
Coming up, a warning from the FBI if your computer is connected to a router.
They can even wipe it out or cause it not to work any longer.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you like this podcast, check out what other podcasts are available from CBS News Radio.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times, okay?
Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez.
That's what this president has always been about. He divides people.
Samantha Bee, our very special guest.
I think I just realized my voice is really boring on podcasts. I'm sorry, everyone.
Not at all. Subscribe now for a new podcast every Friday morning, The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A new warning from the FBI to many folks using the internet. Here's correspondent John Schumo.
We're in your guest room.
where you keep your router.
Like millions of Americans, Alyssa Domnitz has a router, the unit that brings internet service to the devices in her home. Routers come in all shapes and sizes, but the government says hundreds of thousands have been infected with malware.
Now I'm kind of freaking a little bit. You made me really worried, John.
The FBI recently put out a public service announcement saying the malware is able to perform multiple functions, including possible information collection, device exploitation, and blocking network traffic.
They can spy on you.
Ed Strauss is the former head of New York City's FBI Computer Crime Squad. He says the infection could give hackers access to personal information or even allow them to disable the router.
They can even wipe it out or cause it not to work any longer.
The FBI has already identified how the hackers got into the routers. Now the agency is asking everyone to do a reboot.
So by turning it off and on, it resets in a way that allows the FBI to identify the devices that were infected.
Alyssa rebooted hers by unplugging it for 5 seconds.
Hopefully that'll do the job.
The reboot should also destroy part of the malware. Experts say you also need to create a new, strong password for your router. John Schumo, CBS News, New York.
New research on sunscreen.
Let's go.
First-time mom Jessica Goldstein keeps 5-month-old Eloise out of the sun as much as possible.
I want to make sure that she's completely protected. I don't want her to get any sort of skin cancer.
Some people find choosing a sunscreen overwhelming with so many options. Now, new research suggests higher SPF sunscreens may be your best bet to avoid sunburn. A recent study in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology found that SPF 100 was more protective than SPF 50. Dr. Daryl Regal is one of the study's authors.
This was a real use study where people actually used it as opposed to testing it in the lab. Because people underapply sunscreen, the higher SPF is more forgiving. And that's really what the advantage was. For the average user, they put on a little less or they skimp a little bit, they're still getting strong protection.
Researchers compared SPF 50 versus 100 on skiers in Colorado. The study found the SPF 50 side of the face was 11 times more likely to burn compared to the SPF 100 side. Dr. Regal advises choosing a sunscreen that's at least SPF 30 or higher.
You want to look for the words broad spectrum, because that means it protects ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B waves. You want something that's water resistant 80 minutes. That's the maximum of protection.
Although Jessica chooses shade over sun.
As I got older and started really understanding what could happen, I realized that I need to be putting on sunscreen.
She now plans to reach for the highest SPF available under the sun. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
Finally this weekend, a woman's sacrifice gives new hope for a little boy. Here's CBS News correspondent Barry Peterson.
There is joy watching an 18-month-old discover the world. But for Manola Gonzalez, these moments might not have happened. Shortly after his birth, doctors discovered that Manolo had a life-threatening defect causing his liver to fail. He was lethargic and wouldn't eat solid food. The only cure was a transplant. And 6 months ago, he got one at Children's Hospital Colorado. Samantha Gonzalez is Manolo's mom.
What happened and how fast did it happen after the transplant?
The moment he woke up.
Really?
A complete 180. He was ready to eat the same day. He was ready to start crawling.
What saved Manolo was a decision by 24-year-old Rebecca LaSalle, a complete stranger, living 700 miles away in Montana, who decided to donate part of her liver to anyone who needed it.
I merely just wanted somebody else to live.
Without even knowing, it wasn't your brother or your cousin or anyone. It was just a someone.
Just someone.
Because?
Because nobody deserves to suffer.
Rebecca is what doctors call an altruistic donor, meaning she gave a part of an organ without specifying who would get it. And this was her second time. 2 years ago, she also donated a kidney. But the liver transplant is a far more difficult and risky operation.
There's very few people in the world who have donated part of their liver and a kidney.
Dr. Elizabeth Pomfret removed part of Rebecca's liver at the University of Colorado Hospital. She says living donor transplants make up about 4% of all liver transplants done in the United States each year.
of that 4%, the number of people who are altruistic donors is extraordinarily small.
But with altruism comes a healthy dose of skepticism.
So she was also evaluated by a psychiatrist and a social worker and a nurse coordinator.
So she really almost had to talk you into this.
In some ways, yes.
What convinced you?
It was her demeanor and her passion and her conviction and her maturity. Let's just see.
Rebecca recently returned to the hospital for a six-month checkup.
Hi.
And for the first time met Manolo, the child she saved.
Hi. He's so sweet. Hi.
This is Manolo.
Hi.
Life-saving for Manolo, life-changing for Samantha.
At that time, I was going through, like, a really hard time with his dad and with what was going on with him. I, like, lost, like, faith in any kind of good person out in the world.
And he saved my life. So the fact that, like, you saved his, like, there's no words I can express to you how thankful I am for what you've done.
If what she did is extraordinary, why she did it is even more impressive. And it all goes back to a lesson her mother drilled into her every day.
Before I could walk to school when I was a little girl, she would say, make the world, and you had to say a better place, and you'd always groan it out. But it was something that actually she did instill in me, and I do want to make the world a better place.
Mom was right.
Yes, Mom was right.
Not only does that explain Rebecca's inspiration.
I don't ever want you to have to feel indebted or feel like you have to say thank you because he deserved it.
It also explains the emotional letter she wrote for Manolo to read when he grows up.
Most of all, I hope that this opportunity will inspire you to help others to make the world a better place.
So this is a story that may never end, because there are many more good deeds yet to come. Barry Peterson, Aurora, Colorado.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.